Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Mississippi River has been called many things: mighty, muddy, the waterway of the American heartland. How about weather vane? Floods not so long ago, big drought last year. Now, barges barely scraping through its shallows. The Army Corps of Engineers is blasting and dredging to clear a channel for the trickle. Mississippi boatmen want scarce water from up the Missouri River. Up the Missouri, they want to hang on tight to the water they've got in case the drought holds. And climate watchers think weather extremes are the new normal. This hour on Point, the drought and the mighty Mississippi. Behind me right there, the sound of rock removal on the Mississippi River. Just last month, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at Thebes, Illinois, trying to clear a channel for barge traffic that is having a very hard time of it. With us right now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Craig Phillip. He's CEO of the Ingram Barge Company, which ferries grain and gravel and more the length of the Mississippi River. Craig Phillip, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Carbondale, Illinois, is Justin Schoaf. He's chair of the Geography and Environmental Science Department at Southern Illinois University. Justin Schoaf, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Craig, first to you. What's the situation right now? I guess there's been a little rain, some snow runoff. Are things better? Are your barges still in trouble?
Tom, I think it would be fair to say that things are not getting worse. We're continuing to be able to navigate along this section south of St. Louis with barges that are loaded to no greater than 9 feet. That compares with our norm, which would be to load these barges to 11 to 12 feet. So we are sacrificing some productivity, but able to keep our operations in service. You're absolutely right that the Corps of Engineers has accelerated a project to blast some things they call rock pinnacles, remove those hard impediments. Okay. And so our operations right now are typically happening during the nighttime hours when the contractors that the Corps has retained are not doing their blasting.
So what percentage of weight in your barges have you had to cut back to take their draft from that regular 11 or 12 feet in the water to 9 feet? How big a cutback is that on the volume that you're carrying?
That's a cutback of between 20 and 25% in terms of the carrying capacity of an individual barge. And beyond that, we typically operate flotillas between St. Louis and Memphis to flotillas that would be numbers of barges up to 30 being pushed by an individual towboat. And most of the operators have reduced their flotilla sizes to about 15 barges. So we're being penalized from a productivity perspective in two ways. We're not loading the barges as deep, and the number of barges that each of our towboats can carry has also been reduced.
What are the main cargoes that would normally be heavily traveling on the river at this time of year, Craig?
The biggest cargoes right now would be grain products that are trying to find their way to the world markets. So that's grain that's been harvested this fall in Illinois and Iowa, and that grain is trying to move south. And then coming north, you have the complementary flows of fertilizer that are trying to move up from the origin points in the Gulf of Mexico to help the farmers get ready for the spring planting season.
They must need to
Beyond
be
that, there's,
sorry.
Excuse me.
They must need to be stockpiling those pretty soon. They're coming up in a couple of months on preparation for planting season.
That's right. Right now would normally be a time, and we have cargoes of fertilizer right now that are moving northbound, so that they're in position when the spring finally comes and the farmers are able to get back in the fields and begin the new season.
Are you confident that you and other barge operators will be able to get back to normal capacity here in the next couple of months, or given the severity of the drought that we saw last year and the possibility of it going on, could this be a continuing problem, Craig?
Well, I'll let Justin speak to what the climatologists might say. During the wintertime, the flows are normally non-moderated anyway because the ground, of course, gets cold, and the snow that does fall typically waits until the spring melt. So we are concerned about about the navigating channel staying open through the months of February and March. It looks very optimistic right now based on what we're hearing from the Corps of Engineers and their climatologists that at least through early February, they are hopeful that we will be able to maintain at least this channel deep enough to move 9-foot barges. Time will certainly tell what happens in the springtime when we would normally be more concerned about high water than low water.
But, yeah.
This is obviously going to be a year like one we've never seen before. So best it would be to say we have our fingers crossed as we look into February and March. That especially plays to the issue that you raised in the opening about whether there will be any water available from the Missouri River that normally is a source of a significant quantity of the water that that makes its way into the Mississippi this time of year.
And, of course, that is these days in no small part a decision not just of nature but of man and officials who control those dams and waterways. Of course, all this really matters. Last August, Charles Ashley, Assistant Master of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, vessel Dredge Jadwin, talked with USA Today about the consequences when water levels on the Mississippi drop to such historic lows.
90% of all the grain is transferred by the river. They get it to the river in silos, then they pump it on the barges, and then they travel up and down the Mississippi River. Without the river being navigable for the boats and stuff that travel up and down the river, that grain don't get there.
Everybody's watching. Just a couple of weeks ago, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois held a meeting between the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Coast Guard, and industry, local stakeholders. He talked with reporters about the importance of maintaining navigation on the Mississippi River.
This is critically important to the economy of the Midwest and of the nation. Literally billions of dollars worth of goods travel that Mississippi River. Important to jobs in the Midwest and to the growth in our national economy.
Craig Phillips is with us, CEO of Ingram Barge Company, with us today out of Nashville, Tennessee. And from Carbondale, Illinois, Southern Illinois, Justin Schoaf is with us from the Geography and Environmental Sciences Department at Southern Illinois University. Justin, let me come to you. I remember as a reporter back in the late 80s, 1988, being right down in your neck of the woods, flew into Paducah, was over to Cairo. They're looking at the Ohio and the Mississippi. And, of course, 1988 was a very, very dry year as well. Looking back on that report, just a few miles up the Ohio from the Mississippi, they had 80 tugboats and 1,000 barges sitting idle, waiting for dredges to open that at least a 9-foot channel there. So, Justin, it's not like we haven't seen, you know, low rivers before. Is there something different? Craig Phillips says it may be a year like one we've never seen. Maybe we're in the midst of it. How do you look at this? One of a kind, unusual, or cyclical?
Well, I think it's certainly noteworthy. I don't know that I would use the term cyclical. I think we have a climate system that exhibits a tremendous amount of variability. And as you noted in your opening statement, if we were here 18 months ago talking, we'd be talking about high river levels and flooding. And so I think that we have to acknowledge that we are part of a climate system that just exhibits all of this uncertainty. And if we look at the U.S. In any year, we can pinpoint a number of noteworthy events. I would say that it's very difficult to call this a noteworthy event in the context of climate change. That attribution is very difficult. But I would say certainly, as we heard a lot with Hurricane Sandy earlier this year, climate change didn't help. Even if we can't blame climate change directly, we can say that warming, for example, has probably made this drought worse than it would be otherwise.
I mean, it wasn't so many months ago that we were in that terrible drought summer of 2012. We were talking with farmers not far from where you're sitting right now, Justin Schoaf, who was telling us that they'd never seen anything like it in their lifetimes. Things improved a little bit before the crops came in, but not as much as people hoped. And now, just in the last day or two, we have this news that 2012 was, by a long shot, the hottest year ever recorded in the U.S. I mean, you can see why people look at this whole picture and start to wonder if we're in new terrain, Justin.
It was absolutely the warmest year in the U.S., and much of that warming was centered on the upper part of the Mississippi River Basin. So certainly that's played a role here. But one issue that's getting a lot of attention right now in the climate science community is the role of temperature in drought. And one of the problems is that temperature can also be an increased temperature can also be the result of drought as well as a cause.
Yeah, can work both ways. Hold that thought, Justin. I've just got Craig for another minute. Craig Phillip, you're in the barge business. Are you confident, looking out on the climate that we live in, that you're going to be able to stay in that business on the Mississippi for the rest of your life, maybe your children's? Is the old muddy going to be there to float your boats?
Well, I look at the last 24 months, and we have seen the most extreme conditions that we have faced in certainly in my 30 years in this business, and that includes 1988. And so we managed to work through the highest water that was ever recorded on the Mississippi. And you'll recall in the fall of 2011, the Corps of Engineers was in the business of blowing holes in levees because the water was so high.
Yeah.
We managed to maintain our operations through that period and through the low water that we've experienced during really almost all of 2012, we've managed to maintain our operations with this now the first presentation that we might have a river closure kind of presenting us right now. Thankfully, most of the system is open, and I would also comment that the collaboration between the Corps of Engineers and the Coast Guard, which is, if you will, the traffic cop that that helps us to manage between the three of us, the industry, the Corps, and the Coast Guard, we've managed to get through these two extraordinary
in tight times, wild times. Craig Phillip with Ingram Barge Company out of Nashville. Thank you for being with us. This is On Point. We'll be back on the Mississippi in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American drought and the mighty Mississippi. We've got a changing climate, barges that can barely move, and big questions about how everything is going to fit together in this century. Here's the classic sound of the long blast of a horn on a tug on the Mississippi River. And it is shallow and dry right now on the river. A little sound here recorded aboard Mississippi Riverboat. Justin Schoaf is with us from Carbondale, Illinois, chair of the Geography and Environmental Sciences Department at Southern Illinois University. With us right now from Memphis, Tennessee as well, Martin Lipinski, director of the Intermodal Freight Transportation Institute, professor of civil engineering at the University of Memphis. Martin Lipinski, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you figure? How bad is the crick in the hose here? How much is being held up by the low river right now, Martin?
Well, what is happening is we're seeing some modal shifts, and that the most critical commodities are now being shifted over to rail.
What qualifies as most critical? Is that chemicals? Is it coal? Is it grain? Is it gravel?
Probably the agricultural commodities are the most important, along with perhaps some coal, but primarily we're seeing a major shift in the agricultural movements over to rail.
Do you think we've reached a point where we have to think about the possibility of a permanent shift in the ratio of what goes on river and what goes on rail in this country, Mr. Lipinski?
Well, I think we have to look at it as the total supply chain system, and you know, there are consequences of looking at large scale modal shifts. You know, for example, you know, one barge carries the equivalent of 16 rail cars or 70 semi tractor trailer loads of dry bulk material.
Yeah.
Now, you know, shifting those commodities would require an increase in capacity. And it would also have some safety and environmental implications.
Because a semi is going to use a lot more diesel than a barge, than a tug.
Exactly. And, you know, does our highway network or our rail network have the capacity to absorb the traffic that is now being carried on the rivers?
We've got serious climate issues here and serious business issues here. I mean, these are long-term investments. Could we build, rail lines along that path that would move everything that the Mississippi moved if we had to, Mr. Lipinski?
Well, sort of, you know, one of the major issues here is who pays for the system. You know, the railroads in this country are private entities, not supported with government funding for infrastructure, whereas the highway and the waterway systems do have systems of some government support for operations through the Corps of Engineers, mm-hmm. or the Federal Highway Administration. So, you know, you have a you have some real issues here with regard to who is going to pay for this added capacity.
So when you look at this as somebody who's watched for a long time, are you thinking that our historic kind of balance of modes, if you will, modes of transportation, is likely to change, to have to change in this century?
Well, I think we are seeing a very definite change right now, a greater shift over to rail. I think we would see a greater shift over to the waterway mode, except for the fact that the waterway mode has to deal with these natural occurring events. So someone would might be more, you know, not as eager to shift modes to the waterway mode, mm-hmm. if they have to worry about reliability and on-time delivery.
Naturally occurring events, which we almost have to put a little bit in quotation marks these days because we're not
right.
completely sure. Everybody wonders. Martin Lipinski, Justin Schoff, let me bring in our listeners. We've got questions and observations here. Fort Collins, Colorado, Robert is calling. Robert, thanks. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to comment that the low flow that we're experiencing in 2013 is not that unusual. During the 1930s through the early 40s, 28,000 was the low point in 1940. 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 occurred commonly during the wintertime.
Robert, when you say 30,000, what do you mean? 30,000 what, Robert?
CFS.
CFS.
And I'm looking at the USGS record.
What CFS, you're beyond my expertise. CFS, what do you mean by that?
That's cubic feet per second.
Are you talking about river flow? Okay.
Yes. Right now, at Thebes, Illinois, you have 70,000 CFS.
Mm-hmm.
So you're almost double what you experience commonly during the 1930s and 1940s.
Hey, Robert, hang on. Let me take that to both my guests. Martin Lipinski, first to you. Go back to the 30s. The chart Robert's looking at, it looks really much worse. What about it?
Well, I'm really not a hydrologist or a hydraulic engineer, so I really don't feel qualified to comment on that. But yes, we have observed these changes throughout the years that has been duly recorded.
Justin Schoff, on the other hand, 1930s is a long time ago, and the way the rivers sort of bounded and used may have changed a lot. Are these good comparisons to make, and what do you take from them?
Yeah, I'd be happy to comment. I think, you know, one of the issues is that we have to think about climate impacts not only from the perspective of the climate events themselves, but rather as events that occur at the intersection of the climate system and our use of resources. And one of the things that we know has happened on large rivers, like especially the Mississippi, mm-hmm. Over the past 40 or 50 years, is that there's been a tremendous amount of engineering. And so, for example, if you look at things like the river stage at Cairo, Illinois, mm-hmm. What you see is a steady increase over time. That's not necessarily the result of a steady increase in absolute flow over time, but rather as a result of engineering projects that have taken place on the river. So I think we shouldn't expect that a particular flow rate should be associated with the same impacts over time, because the way that the river behaves changes over time. And the way that we use the river changes over time. So we could all certainly imagine that there's a tremendous increase in river traffic now relative to what there was in the 1930s.
Do you see a trend line in navigability, in water flow on the Mississippi? Is there a traceable trend line over time in this century that we're told, you know, some warming's already occurred and lined up for more?
I think that there's been an increase in variability. And so we see this as, for example, the flood in 2011, the drought in 2012, and what we're experiencing now. That seems to be one of the stories that comes out of the climate science literature is increasing variability. Now, historically, in the U.S., we've seen some warming over the last few decades, but we've also seen more precipitation. So despite our current situation, this has led to an overall sort of weakening of drought severity over time.
Mm-hmm.
But without that precipitation increase, drought would have likely increased along with temperature. If we have a long-term increase in temperature of a few degrees, as climate models would suggest, and that's coupled with less precipitation, it's difficult to imagine that drought will not become more prevalent.
Martin Lipinski, you're in the transportation business. Variability is a pretty big deal. I mean, a road is there or it's not, a rail is there or it's not. A river can come and go depending on factors. I mean, how do you deal with, how important is variability when it comes to the Mississippi? How do you deal with that? Can we have redundancy to just work around it all the time?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you make that point. Actually, we just, in June of 2011, with one of our research partners at Vanderbilt University, sponsored a summit meeting on climate change and the freight industry. And we brought together leaders from the rail, the barge, and other industries to talk about what they're doing to look at some of these issues. And we had leaders like your previous guest, Craig Phillip.
Yes.
Who participated and was very, very active in the discussions. Basically, we found that it is very difficult for people to invest money in events that might have low probabilities of occurrence.
So something terrible could happen here, but how do you invest to be ready for it when you're not sure, when you've got the variability that Justin's talking about?
That's right. You know, railroads are doing, for example, some things. They're raising their road beds in locations, say, around the New Orleans area, the CN Railroad and others. And certainly the thinking that goes into planning or operating ports on the Mississippi River are being modified to take into consideration that there will be more variability, and that any design issues that the engineers are tackling, you know, must take this into account.
Robert,
there are some folks that are you know, making moves in that direction.
Right, Robert in Colorado. What are you thinking as you listen to this? That we've got a new situation here, or we can just plow along merrily as we always have, Robert?
Well, I will say couple things. One, we only have 100 years of record at most, and that's a stage record on the Mississippi River. Mm. Flow record, the USGS flow record starts in 1933. The Corps of Engineer record goes back to 1900. I'm also looking at the year 1988, and this is at St. Louis once again, and you drop to as low as 50 some thousand CFS.
Yeah. So you're saying we've been here is kind of your point, and we don't know the whole big picture. I mean, I was on the river in '88. Well, boy, it was small, it was low. You could have practically walked across it down by Cairo, or certainly swum across it. I was tempted, but who wants to get into that? Robert, I take your point. I appreciate your call, Martin Lipinski. What was your conclusion from your freight and climate change summit meeting? Do you see big change coming? Are you preparing?
Oh, absolutely. We have we are now conducting a further in-depth studies. We have an additional research project that's underway to team up climatologists and people in the freight industry to take a better look at what is the best way that which we can prepare for these climate change, and how can we best build infrastructure to meet this challenge.
One more call for you, Beverly in East Sautucket, New York. Beverly, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, Tom, thank you. Historically, we took grain through the Erie Canal and then the St. Lawrence Seaway down to New York at a time when the grain industry was just growing.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem to me they ought to consider going back and trying to see if going the other way, you buy the St. Lawrence Seaway or some other built canal, would solve this problem, especially if it's going to be on a long-term basis.
Interesting suggestion. Martin Lipinski, how about it? Turn back the hands of time. We've got to take it from south to north and back to the, you know, Erie Canal. What do you say?
Well, I think that the people involved in making these decisions are looking at the total supply chain, which might include also taking the grain by rail to the West Coast, because most of the grain coming down the Mississippi is grain for export. So, you know, we're looking at the export grain, and if we are working with our trading partners in Asia, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to take it to the East Coast.
Can we stay viable and efficient no matter which way we take it? Competitive, Martin?
Well, I think someone is going to have to absorb the extra cost that may be involved. But yes, because I think the world is being more dependent on our exports, especially grain and other kinds of raw materials.
Martin Lipinski is director of the Intermodal Freight Transportation Institute, professor of civil engineering at the University of Memphis. Joined us today from Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Lipinski, thank you so much for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Tom.
I want to go right on down the river, if we could here for a second, to New Orleans. Justin Schoaf, please stand by there in Carbondale. From Louisiana, New Orleans, Gerald Galloway joins us. He was a presidential appointee to the Mississippi River Commission, led the White House study of the Great Mississippi River Flood of 1993, professor of civil and environmental engineering, affiliate at the University of Maryland, retired Army Brigadier General Gerald Galloway. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this very important subject.
It's great to have you. Look, as we look at this, we're reading a lot about the possibility of a water war here. I'm seeing it described in the press anyway, Gerald Galloway. The Missouri River wants to hang, people along the Missouri want to hang on to a lot of that, the water they've got up there for all kinds of reasons. Fracking, not least among them. People on the Mississippi saying, we're in trouble here, let that water go. Are we looking at serious tension over water in the midst of this and where it flows?
Well, it's interesting. This tension comes and goes, just like the droughts and the floods. I want to start by saying that we have perhaps one of the greatest inland waterway systems in the world. The 9-foot navigation channel that's guaranteed by the law is essentially runs from New Orleans, where I am, which is the nation's, the southern Louisiana is the nation's number one port in terms of tonnage,
yeah,
and it does the export. We have this great waterway system. It's one use of the river. The challenge you face is that when we have a drought or we have a flood, immediately thereafter or in the middle of the crises, people want to reorganize how we're operating this particular river. I was on the commission in 1988, and we went through many of the same issues that you've seen and heard of in the last couple of weeks. We said, let's study it. And so a study began in 1989 of the Missouri, how it should be operated, and what the authorizations were that were given to the Missouri River that should be changed. And should the Missouri be operated in a different fashion than actually it was at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The study went on and never came to an official conclusion because you could never get the states in the Missouri River Basin to agree with each other. At the same time, you have people in the Upper Miss who want to do some things, the people in the Ohio Basin. And incidentally, the bulk of the water that gets into the Mississippi comes from the Ohio in the
right.
east or in the north, not from the west. And so the people in the Missouri Basin guard their water quite critically. They're very zealous in protecting their resource. Now, the split is the upstream states want to hold on to it as long as they can, and the downstream states want to see it available for navigation on the lower Missouri and for water supply and other sorts of uses. And in 2002, the National Research Council completed a study at the request of the Corps of Engineers about the Missouri, and it came back and said, you have too many laws and conflicting rules and regulations that have come from the Congress that deal with this issue, and they need to be straightened out.
And, but you've got a cry going up right now. I mean, I'm reading here from the Des Moines Register. They say, in fact, the Corps is making matters far worse under the delusion it has no choice but to follow inflexible orders to reduce the flow of the Missouri River into the Mississippi River. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American drought and the mighty Mississippi. Right now, not so mighty at the moment. We've got a changing climate, barges that can barely move, and some big questions about how all this will sort out, how we may need to rebalance transportation, and maybe much more than that, to make it work. Gerald, Justin, let me get to our callers. Carol in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Carol, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What about the big, tough new kid on the block, fracking? Living on Earth out of your station in Boston reported that They're the biggest new competitor, and I haven't heard anything other than what Living on Earth put out about it. What about fracking? They demand a huge amount of water.
It's a good question, and it's true. I don't know, Gerald, I'll come first to you on that. South Dakota's got a boom underway and much more to come, and is saying very explicitly, we need Missouri River water in part for fracking. How big a draw on the water supply might that be, Gerald?
Well, I think that that remains to be seen. Fracking is certainly expanding in the West now, in North Dakota in particular, but it's been on the East Coast, and we've seen the demands for water. It depends on what time of year, what percentage of the available water would go to fracking. But it is very clear that to hedge their bets, the states that are in this area that would be possible fracking sites are most interested in maintaining what they have and not seeing it be sent down the river unnecessarily being their perspective.
What about for irrigation and food crops and pasturage even in that area?
Exactly. You have irrigation issues, you have municipal and industrial water supply issues, you have nuclear power plants that need to be cooled. All of these things have to be taken into account. As the water gets lower on the Missouri, it affects water intakes farther in Kansas and in Missouri. It affects them in other locations. So it's a carefully balanced issue. We have to figure out how it should all be put together. And what we have now is a failure on the part of the Congress and the administration over the last 20 years to act on this challenge. It's gone to the courts, and the judges have said, look, we understand what the Corps of Engineers says about their laws. They are these laws. The Corps is doing the best to balance them. And the judge says, I'm going to stay out of it until the Congress steps up and tries to adjudicate this.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, the Congress authorized a study to look at the uses of the Missouri water to see how it should be distributed. Could it go into the Mississippi? And you know what? The Congress didn't fund that study. And so how do you move ahead when for 20 years, since 88, we've recognized that there's this challenge, but nobody wants to address it because it's certainly a very big political hot potato.
I mean, we may be forced to address it here. Again, in this piece in the Des Moines Register saying, yes, you've got your Flood Control Act of 1944 about water, what goes to the Missouri into the Mississippi and what doesn't. Saying the Corps' unwillingness to save the day by increasing the flow of the Missouri River into the Mississippi comes out of that act. But this writer, this is Jay Lair, says most legal scholars believe, Gerald Galloway, that the Act 44 offers the flexibility to mitigate disasters out of its own watershed. Is there flexibility in here to open up the spigot off the Missouri to help out on the Mississippi here after all?
Well, we've seen this discussions before. In 88, it's happened. It's happened at one time during 88, they were looking to take water out of the Great Lakes and down the Illinois River. Same issue. That one is a Supreme Court level judgment. The Corps interprets, as with the help of the administration, interprets the laws as they're written. And when you bring in outsiders who come in and say, look, we've looked at this, the judges look at this, and they all say, you can't resolve this without taking action to change the laws and modify them so you're properly adjusting the balance. You give away the water now and you lean it later, the consequences have to be developed, and somebody has to agree that that's the way you want to run this very large basin.
You know, Justin Schoff, as I listen to all this, I'm thinking, Gerald Galloway says quite rightly, I'm sure, that we have a very carefully balanced water system here. And no doubt people have for many years looked to, in that balance, optimize it for a historical range of waterfall and flow in the rivers and industries using it. But we've got changes here. I mean, you didn't have fracking over those decades. And you didn't have the full impact, whatever it may be, of climate change that we have now. Do we have to find a new balance, Justin?
Well, I think what's really reflected in the exchange I just heard between you and Gerald is that, you know, we already have a lot of existing pressure on water resources
right. In
many parts of our country, even in the absence of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So climate change certainly isn't going to help. When we look at climate models, which tell us about expected changes or possible changes in climate over the next century or so, what we see for this region is that precipitation is likely to increase on an annual basis.
Okay.
But the devil's in the details. So when we look at the models and what they tell us overall, we see expected increases in winter and spring. That's especially true across the upper part of the Mississippi basin.
Mm-hmm.
But the story's different in the summer. So we see even values or even decreasing precip in the summer. And it's also the case that we expect summer precipitation to become more extreme. So we expect to see maybe fewer events, but more precipitation during those events. So if we use the parlance of hydrologists, we would say that the river is likely to become more flashy, right? So we're
right.
going to have a lot
right.
more variability and flow. So while there's a lot of variability in the results from climate models when we look at them, there is some information that we can extract. So uncertainty in this context doesn't mean that we don't know anything.
Gerald Calloway, when you hear that sort of prognostication, if it does emerge something like what Justin Schoff is describing, who knows? But if it does, is that manageable in transportation terms, in river transportation terms?
Well, certainly. And I think we just have to accept the fact that these are not laws that prohibit you changing from year to year and even under certain circumstances within a season, but there are some bounds that you don't want to go beyond. Every year in the Missouri Basin, the Corps of Engineers brings the people together, the stakeholders, and say, okay, this is our current plan. We have a master guide that shows this is how we're going to do it. This is the forecast we see. This is how we think it's going to work. Let's talk about it and see what adjustments within certain parameters we need to make. But one of the prohibitions is the water is authorized for use for navigation on the Missouri and
yep.
not the Mississippi.
Yep.
And that's there. That with a quick pen, somebody could change that. But I will tell you, if you were to take that to the floor of the Senate or the House,
yeah.
you're going to have a real debate.
But when it's as finely balanced as you're describing, I mean, people have paid close attention for a long time. If you get new factors, new dynamics, new industries, new climate patterns in here, I mean, I think a lot of people scratch their head and are not so sure that, well, that it'll, I mean, here's one of our listeners, Andrea, writes. She says, many people seem to have the idea that it is possible to negotiate climate change. It isn't, she writes. We're nothing in relation to the forces we have unleashed. What do you think when you hear that, Gerald Calloway?
Well, I think she's right. We don't know, as Justin has said,
mm-hmm.
The uncertainties connected with climate change are quite large. We're talking about predictions for the end of this century. We're beginning to see in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest some climate change factors that are going to influence more immediately some of the flood issues that we're talking about. But again, that's why this study that was initially commissioned to look at how should we, in the changing dynamics of business, in the changing dynamics of climate, in the political dynamics of this particular basin, how should we really operate the Missouri River? And the Congress chose not to do anything about that study, not to fund it. You can't solve problems if you don't seek the answers.
Well, if you get enough barges piled up and maybe the funding comes through. Elizabeth in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
If Congress isn't going to act, there's a lot of things the states can be doing. Maybe the two gentlemen can talk about the stream mitigation programs. We've been systematically tearing up and burying our streams and tributaries in a lot of states through a program that the Army Corps has run. The program in a lot of states is a huge failure. We've lost literally thousands and thousands of linear feet of stream that have just been buried, and those streams and tributaries carry water to these bigger rivers.
And what's been the idea? Why, in the stream mitigation program, why have they, as you say, buried these, Elizabeth?
Well, if the stream is in the middle of a Costco or you know whatever store wants to build on
parking lot,
acres,
yeah, okay,
yeah, they get a permit, the state gives it to them, and they count up the linear feet of stream and write a check. So the stream gets buried, and the check goes into a fund, and then it's who knows where the money's going to go or what kind of program it's going to go into.
Doesn't the water still end up in the Mississippi? I mean, doesn't it more or less have to end up there or not?
No. A lot of these streams are buried. Tennessee, for example, has a huge karst system, so we have underground rivers here. So now your water can be 100, 200 feet underground. Your gentleman could talk about that.
Sure.
It's a phenomenon in a lot of states, and other states they don't have it. Florida, the mitigation program has been a huge disaster.
Let us pick it up, Gerald Calloway. What about stream mitigation along the Mississippi, for starters?
I think we're talking in many cases about a very small contribution to the river versus the larger ones of the major rivers. But
okay.
groundwater, if it gets into the ground, groundwater is a major source of flow during the low periods.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. If you, in fact, as the caller suggests, allow somebody to cover over a wetland, what you're doing is mitigating the loss of that wetlands by putting it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, as you suggested, that water would be somewhere. That water that was flowing into the Costco has to go somewhere else and has to be diverted around. And she's absolutely right. The states can play a very important role of managing their natural resources and trying to keep the flows in the rivers where they've been. But in some cases, people are trying to store more water. You know, we have farm ponds. We have 85,000 dams in this country. Each of those is holding back some water for some purpose.
And some of those people would like to open the spigot on right now for the Mississippi. Joe in Framingham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on. Over the last 20 years, Ted Turner has been quietly buying up something like 2 million acres of land along like rivers like the Missouri River. He's bought in 11 states, New Mexico, Nebraska, Montana, and South Dakota. He sees water as being the next big issue, and he has been buying up water rights and property. In his latest purchase in Mullen, Nebraska, he has access to the Ogallala Aquifer, the largest underground water supply. So water is going to be is going to be a real issue. And Ted Turner, you know, is basically putting his money there. I mean, water could become more expensive than oil in the future.
I mean, he's been early and he's been right before on cable television, and he certainly knows land purchases.
He's been featured on Good Morning America, so this isn't a farce. I mean,
no, let us pick it up, and I'm glad you raise it, Joe. Justin, what are you thinking as you hear that? I mean, I was reading somewhere in this packet about a call, I don't know if it's true, to build a big pipeline, water pipeline, from the same sort of along the Missouri, but to the west instead of have it feeding into the Mississippi because you've got development and demand out that way. I don't know about Ted Turner, but our caller says he sees a big demand coming for this water, and I guess that means more conflict over it, Justin.
I think that sort of reflects the point that we covered a short time ago about conflict over water resources. And I think historically in the U.S., we've tended to think of this as a problem in the West. And I think what we're experiencing now and what we're going to continue to experience is that water resources are going to be even more closely guarded than they are now in places like the Midwest and potentially even the East as we move forward in time.
Peter in Enid, Oklahoma. Peter, you're on the air. Hello, Peter. Are you there, my friend?
Hi, this is Pete Pastor. I am in Oklahoma. We are dying of thirst down here, and I'd like to point out that there is a project that has been on the drawing board since the 60s called NWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, and it involves diverting unused flow from Alaska and the Yukon territories down into the west, also feeding into the Missouri and the Great Lakes.
That's a long way to go for water, but water's an absolute necessity. You say you're dying for water in Enid. What's the evidence of that, Peter?
We've been in a drought for 3 years.
That's pretty strong evidence.
That's pretty strong evidence. I mean, it's been subpar. It's been 20% of our average rainfall for the last 3 years, and we're getting crop failures. We're getting water restrictions and wildfires. It's just, what else do you have to point to?
Yeah,
we've
seen the reports. I appreciate your call, Peter. I mean, Gerald Galloway, are we going to have to sort of, you know, shake up the whole playing board here if we've got climate patterns changing, as Justin Shove points out? Different patterns coming in here, growing demand, you know, people talking about bringing water from Alaska. The Mississippi can't move its barges well right now. Do they need to get back for that big summit meeting to think all this through?
Well, I think it's bigger than just the barges on the river. It's
sure.
We haven't had a national water assessment since 1976. We haven't addressed water. It's sort of what we've taken for granted. The NWAPA project was pushed aside because it really wasn't realistic, and there's lots of challenges that we learned when we became more environmentally conscious. They've talked about taking it out of Hudson's Bay and shipping it down. When you have these massive interbasin transfers, you create all sorts of problems. Both environmental problems and logistical problems. It costs an awful lot to pump the water uphill, and you have to get over some pretty big hills to move some of this water. But all of this says we need to be taking a comprehensive look at our national water use. We do have problems, and we need to address them. And the federal agencies have sponsored a series of water resource policy dialogues, and they always come out with the first thing, what's the goal, what's our objective for the use of the nation's water? And we don't have a really good handle on it. We have 50 state laws. The states control water use. So we have 50 state laws that speak to their particular needs, which is appropriate under our system, but we somehow have to bring everybody together so they can sit down and deal with the states and the tribes and the people that are the professionals in this business and try and sort out a long-term answer.
Well, Mother Nature and climate change and fracking operators and barge operators and a whole lot more speaking to us right now in that Mississippi flow and those slowed barges there. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us in this hour to open our eyes a little bit. Gerald Galloway, joining us today from New Orleans. Thank you so much, General Galloway, for being here.
Well, thank you very much for asking.
Great to have you. And Justin Schoaf at Southern Illinois University. Thank you so much for your insights, Professor Schoaf.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Emily Johnson, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.